Hello and welcome to another episode of Everything is Canon, a CineLinks podcast, a podcast where we discuss the latest books and novels with the people who wrote them. I'm your host, Steve Duncan. However you may have found your way here, thanks so much for tuning in. If you like that intro music, then you've got great taste. That's Sam Witwer and the Crash Tones. If you want to hear more of the Crash Tones, you can download their latest album, Revenge of the Crash Tones, on iTunes or visit samwitwer.com. So we're back after a little summer break, and to get us back into the swing of things, we've got a great guest joining us today to talk all things publishing. Some of you will know Justina Ireland from her Star Wars work, Spark of the Resistance, Lando's Luck, and next year's The High Republic, A Test of Courage. Others will most certainly know her from her 2018 best-selling novel Dread Nation, and this year's incredible follow-up to that book, Deathless Divide. However you know Justina, you know she's passionate, outspoken, funny, charming, intelligent, and ultra-talented. I've spoken to her before, and it's for all these reasons and more I couldn't wait to talk to her about 2020, a year that no one could have imagined. So in that spirit, we talk about the state of publishing, supporting black authors, Star Wars, killing zombies, and of course, politics. No need for a spoiler warning on this one. Enjoy. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. Really excited about today's guest, one of my favorites. I've spoken to her before on a few other occasions. Back then, it was just pretty much Star Wars related. But now that the door's been blown wide open here, we could talk about all sorts of other good things, like why she's listening to the Doobie Brothers on a Monday morning. But as you can tell by the laugh, which is my favorite in the industry, welcome to the show, Justina Ireland. Hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Sorry, I was just on Twitter there kind of flipping around and I noticed you put up a Doobie Brothers record. That was your listening lineup, was it? That was your thing?
Yeah, I usually try to pick a couple albums to listen to in a day because I'm one of those people who likes to listen to an album on repeat a couple times.
Me too.
And I like vinyl because I like being able to like, It gives me a break to get up out of my chair instead of being sedentary for like, you know, 9 hours a day. And the Doobie, like I saw Michael McDonald was trending on Twitter and Doobie Brothers and I was like, man, I haven't listened to the Doobie Brothers in a while. And so like, yeah, so I got out my old dusty vinyl of the Doobie Brothers and I was listening to it before we jumped on the call here.
We were just talking about sort of how technology has passed me anyways. The only thing I collect still like old, you know, old school, I'll say, is books. I'm always going to buy books. And like you, I have a pretty large LP collection. I still buy LPs. I've got many. And I was listening to the Hollies this morning, actually, while you were listening to the Doobie Brothers. So nice. I have a similar routine to get up, put something on, and then make coffee and do whatever. So
I really like how like vinyl has made like this cool comeback in the last like 5-10 years. I mean, especially like now bands are releasing new albums. Yep. And I'm like, you know, talk about being old. I'm at the stage in my life where I don't want new bands. I just want to hear new music by the bands I already like. So I'm just like, just tell me what I need to listen to now and I'll go listen to that. And so it's really cool because, you know, in the last year, I've gotten both the new Hold Steady album, the new American Aquarium album, and the new Jason Isbell album all on vinyl, like direct release the week it came out. And it's just really nice to be able to get like, you know, have your old favorites, especially since the vinyl, like the newer ones are so much better quality, like this, like that really heavy duty, like 180 gram vinyl. But I'm the same way. I don't like eBooks. I have an e-reader, but like for when I have to read things, e-reader, but I always try to get a paper arc or a physical copy of a book because it's just, I like technology. I'm not a Luddite or Luddite, however you pronounce that. But I definitely love like the physical media, the experience of like picking up an album and putting it on the turntable or opening a book and like reading, turning the pages.
Part of that obviously is it's a mirror to the past too, because we're old enough that we remember when it was just records, right? So, and the kids of today won't, you know, just don't relish that the same way we did of going to buy it and getting to read all the liner notes and the beautiful artwork. And it's I'm with you too with books. I have my iPad and I'm, you know, fortunate enough to get things early sometimes. And I'm always like, oh, here's a NetGalley link. I'm like, you have any physical arcs?
I know. And it's one of the worst things about has been about the pandemic is that it's really impacted book production. So there are less and less physical arcs now. So if somebody sends me a book and they're like, hey, we'd like you to do a blurb. I'm like, oh, are you guys doing physical arcs? Because I hate asking for physical arcs. But honestly, if you want me to actually read a book, the chances are like triple if it's a physical arc compared to like a digital link.
I'm the exact same. I struggle with e-readers and stuff, but yeah. It's like you said, it's a changing world.
So the last time we spoke was about a year ago, and
nothing really has happened in the world since then. I don't know what we're going to talk about. but before we move on, because I know you're sort of in that neck of the woods, I just want to please be everybody in Lancaster this morning. Be safe today. There was another shooting, and are you still in Pennsylvania?
I'm not. I'm across the border in Maryland. Okay. But okay. I am like spitting distance to Baltimore now. So it's okay. Like,
right.
But I'm like, yeah, I saw that. I woke up this morning. I get like, we get a lot of the Pennsylvania news because of sure. where we are. And yeah, I'm not. Also, I have to tell you, in Pennsylvania, it's pronounced Lancaster.
Lancaster. Okay, that's good to
Instead
know.
Instead of Lancaster. Yeah, so it's always fun. You can tell somebody who's from Central Pennsylvania or not is because it's like Lancaster. But yeah, I lived in Central Pennsylvania probably the last 10 years.
Okay.
And we just moved a couple years ago down to Maryland just because my husband's work is closer to his work.
Sure.
I woke up this morning and I was like really unsurprised. This is like,
yeah,
I mean, like most of these cities, like when these things actually bubble up to the surface, it's been an issue for a long time. And you're just now hearing about it on the national
sure. level. Right. Absolutely. And that's like one of the big things. And people are just at home more and watching things right. more. And it's a combination of all this stuff. But I just wanted to say peaceful protesters to the folks in Lancaster. And please, boys in blue, just be gentle and try not to shoot anybody today if you can help it.
like you have a taser for a reason. Like use your taser.
I don't like, can you not just shoot somebody in the knee once in a while? I don't know. It's beyond me. And then, but then you start to think about, and you've got much more knowledge on this than I do. I know you were in the military and stuff. So that would involve a certain amount of training for sure. But then you start thinking about, you know, like, the training stuff, and listen, most of my gun related stuff, my knowledge comes from watching movies, so but I know like ranges and stuff, it is literally just like the kill zone, or what do they call it,
center mass.
Yes thank you. That's exactly what I was thinking of. You know, and you look at things like that and you're just like, okay, that's definitely part of the problem. Like
I think it is, like, when, you know, that's one of the things people always come back to. They're like, well, you know, that's the training. But when I was in the Army, and every single time we went to a range, part of the thing you emphasized on was weapon control. Like, you don't want to shoot your entire like magazine load down range. Like, you want to very carefully pick targets and like squeeze off bullets. Because like that's part of the thing is conservation resource, especially if you're in a war zone, you don't have necessarily a supply chain, or like you have logistics concerns are always one of the reasons like wars are lost. And so it's really strange when, like, for me as somebody who like who has shot, right, has done shooting and has been on ranges and has, you know, carried, you know, a number of different weapons, to see someone shoot someone 7 times, right? Like, because it's like I would never like empty the clip, right? Like, well, that, and that's like never how we were trained. And so like I'm like, is this what the training is in local police precincts, is like just like squeeze the trigger and keep pulling it until it doesn't go anymore? Or I mean, cause that's, you know, that's a huge concern if that's the truth.
Right. But that's, it scares me because like, that's how I would shoot a gun. right. Like that's something that I would close my eyes. I'm like, it's the comedy shooting, right? Like my eyes are closed.
Seem a little, close your eyes and just keep squeezing. Yeah.
If the gun is sideways, just not because it's cool, because I don't know how to hold a gun. But like, and that's the disturbing part is like, and then especially the proximity when they're so close, they can literally aim and hit anywhere they want. And they're choosing to, you know, deploy lethal, this year has been just obviously you wouldn't believe me if I, like, if we, you know, last October, if I would have laid this year out for you, you would have been like, nah, bullshit. Not the systematic part of it, which we'll talk about,
but
just how, like you just said, you used a great word there a second ago, and normally it would only apply to one specific situation. You said war zone, but now it's like, it feels like the fucking States is a goddamn war zone right now.
Yeah.
Between the fires on the West Coast, hurricanes on the East, and then all the shootings in between, up, down, left and right. And it's just, it's unbelievable. And then I've spoken to, you know, one of the things changing venues for myself, one of the big motivations was I wanted to do more that I could. And so I've talked to a lot of Black authors this year, and you know, they've all said the same thing. They're like, they can't, especially the ones that have put out books like The Black Kids, right, by Miss Reeds, and, you know, which looks at the 92 riots and stuff. And
yeah.
And then, you know, and we'll look and we'll talk about Deathless Divide. I mean, you just couldn't, to have these books come out this year is just, you know, you can't believe it in a way. It seems surreal, even though it's happening, right? Like, does it just feel nuts or?
Yeah, I mean, it's to the point where science fiction and dystopian fiction, like, isn't fiction anymore, which makes, like, my job harder and harder, because it's like, you know, like, I wrote Dread Nation. I mean, Dread Nation was published in 2018. I probably started writing it 2014, 2015. It was completed before the 2016 election. And people are picking that book up now, and they're like, it's like you predicted the future. Like, right. It's zombies, not a pandemic, but it's a different kind of pandemic. And the stuff that's in the book is stuff that's historically been true. And so it's really hard to, like, it's really hard to have that level of fiction, because fiction usually skews a little bit into the ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of like how you bring a reader along and you make things feel more high stakes than like regular life. But when in regular life, it's like the tension and the potential for loss is so freaking high every day. It's really hard to get fiction to feel fantastic. Because you're just like, you're up against reality, and reality is kind of a horror show right now. So it's like, well, shit, like, what am I supposed to do? Like, I mean, like, and you brought up Deathless Divide. Like, one of the things I wanted to talk about was, you know, how vaccines work and how, you know, Black people have historically been experimented on and, you know, have borne the brunt of that. You know, like, if you know, for those who aren't familiar, you know, there's the story of the Tuskegee syphilis experiment. And then we have, you know, the Moral Life of Henrietta Lacks, which is actually just down the road in my hood at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, who is now one of our like leading public health centers in tracing, you know, this COVID outbreak. So like, it's like, you see all this stuff, how it's wrapped up. And so when I wrote that book, I was like, I want to talk about, you know, how vaccines come into being in a time where people hate vaccines, and like, especially like, you know, it seems like affluent white people. And literally now we're in a pandemic and people are emailing me. They're like, I can't believe you're an anti-vaxxer in the pandemic. I'm like, that's not the point of the story. Also, I didn't predict a pandemic. like I didn't know the book about, you know, vaccines would be coming out during a time where vaccines are a highly controversial, or wearing a mask is a highly controversial topic. So it's like, as a creative, it's like, I'm really interested to see how other people are kind of like dealing through our pandemic year, because it's like, it's not just like a pandemic of COVID. It's a pandemic of police violence. It's a pandemic of racism. It's like all these factors that have, you know, it's a pandemic of poverty. People are starting to like, you know, lose their homes and stuff like that. And so you just see how all these ills in society are just stacking up on one another, like the worst Lego wall ever. And it's just like trying to like write a story that like can dissect those things in a fantastical realm. It is not anything anybody should have to try to figure out, because it is hard.
It's really hard. So like, and even having said all of that, like, what can I say to you to get you to change your mind and not vote for Donald Trump? Like, what can I say to you? Right, is there anything I can, no?
Well, I mean, that's,
and listen, but and before you start getting angry messages, Justina is not voting. I'm pretty sure she's not voting for Donald Trump. But
I didn't vote from the first time, and I won't vote.
Put your vote, your privacy out in the air like that. But
I will happily tell anybody.
One trip down your Twitter account.
A very short trip to my Twitter timeline.
Yes. But and again, to your point, like, you know, this is a, God, this is like the worst analogy. It's also like the whitest analogy too, and I'm embarrassed by it. But I remember they were talking about James Bond movies at some point, and they said at one point it became a struggle because at one point technology had caught up to imagination, And they had a hard time writing James Bond stories because they were so focused on the gadgets, and they had to actually start, heaven forbid, focus on character. And, that's when we started getting like the Daniel Craig type of Bond films, like dealing with PTSD and different things like this. And, you know, the consequences of murdering 10,000 people. Over and, which he did. I'm sorry, he did. But, but just, again, to your point, it's like, how do you write, you know, speculative fantasy fiction, especially in the genre like Dread Nation and, you know, Deathless Divide? You're right. Yeah. Like, I mean, it'll be interesting to see the stuff that comes out of this year in fiction.
I think we're going to see, you know, for a long time, cyberpunk has kind of like languished, just because we, you know, like Johnny Mnemonic, like what was it? It was like a 1 gigabyte disc that was in his brain that he was trying to like, like now we're like on like Quadrera bikes. I don't even know where we're at. And so like, it's like, oh, Johnny, you're so cute. I'm just getting USB guy. And so like, it's just like it'll be interesting to see how, because I think now personal security, especially after like, you know, the whole Cambridge Analytica issues and stuff like that. And now like with the TikTok stuff, it's like, it's interesting. The Zoom call, you know, we have the Zoom stuff that happened earlier this year. And so I think like our next, like, I think that next frontier really will be that kind of cyberpunk, dealing with like, what does it look like when to live in a world where we're all connected, whether we want to be or not.
Sure.
But I also am really excited for people doing things kind of like what the Lovecraft Country TV show is doing, where we go back in time and show you what the world was like from the perspective of someone who's not white and affluent. Because a lot of our, you know, if you want to watch anything from the 1950s, it's like I Love Lucy and Leave It to Beaver. And it's like, you know, very much the sanitized version of living in America. And now we have, you know, we have the ability to kind of take those portraits, that nostalgia, and like show it for what it is. And so I am really excited from like for stuff that's doing that kind of thing, that using that juxtaposition of horror and history to kind of like illuminate the past and like the realities of it.
Right. And that's one of the great things too about your book, books. There's, you know, it's for sure entertaining, but there's education there too. And I don't even think it's even subtle. Like, I think it's pretty obvious. And that's, you know, one of the great things too, we'll talk about a bit, but how it, you know, in a lot of books this year too, you know, should hopefully inspire people to learn more about the past. And you brought up Lovecraft, which is great. Last night was nuts. I don't know if you saw last night, but
I didn't. I'm like two episodes behind. I'm trying to stretch it out. Like I did the same thing with Watchmen. I like to savor it. Also, it's a lot of trauma. And so it's like,
it
like
is.
Sometimes you watch an episode and I'm like angry for a couple hours afterwards. So I don't want to like just go into the next episode. So I'm like two episodes behind.
Yeah. All right. And then, so fair warning about the end of episode 4. So not last night, but the week before, they get into some weird stuff, which sort of upset some people, but you'll see. But that show is, if anything, has been doing a lot of triggering and a lot of, you know, teaching people things about, like, it's amazing to me how many people didn't know what sundown towns were and, you know, things like that. Yeah. And so shows like that are great. Even like it's even that. And I'm glad you brought up Watchmen, another great example too. And it's come up in a couple of books this year too, just Tulsa. Like, how many people didn't know about Tulsa? Like, it's crazy, you know, I don't know. I guess people just choose to know what they know. And yeah, I don't know.
I think it's also like, it's also part of like how we teach kids in school.
Yeah.
And I think it's a large part of it. Like, most people don't do any history other than what they're forced to do.
Sure.
So it's like two classes in college, a class in American history during high school, and then like your social studies that you get in like your lower school. Mm-hmm. And like, I have a 12-year-old. And so, you know, she just started 7th grade. And so when she comes to me and she asks me, I'm like, what are you learning in school? Like, what are you talking about? And she'll tell me this stuff. And I was like, well, that's not really what happened. And like, we'll have these long conversations about talking about, like, you know, like, it wasn't like the land was completely empty when people showed up here. Like, there were like Native American tribes, like living like very full, fulfilling lives. And then like, you know, like there's like, they downplay a lot of like the slavery stuff. So, you know, like we talk about, like, you know, like it wasn't just like, you know, slavery was one of these things that like everybody had a couple slaves. It was like very rich people had a whole bunch of slaves. And, you know, like they use that to build family wealth, and those families still have wealth from those days. Right. Mm-hmm. And so like, I think that's part of the challenge is like, if you start off on the, like the foot of George Washington was a great hero, never mind, you know, the slavery, then what happens is all of history tends to follow that path. And you miss things like the Tulsa race riots, or redlining, or, you know, like integrating schools, and why in United States, the Christian school, you know, tradition is like starts in the 1950s when schools are being integrated, like all these right. things that like that go together, because like that's, and I think that's what is hard for my daughter to understand. And I think for a lot of people to understand is like, things aren't just like this. Like things aren't just like, oh, there's a couple of people who are cops and they're bad people. Like, no, it's institutional forces at play. People have made decisions at different levels to make things like this, and we have the ability to change those decisions. And so, yeah, like I do think that, like, in, you know, in a lot of ways, it's like you should not be getting your history from like fiction. But at the same time, if we can get you something, that's better than nothing.
Oh, hey, if that's what it takes, then I'm all for it. I'm with you. Yeah, yeah. Because, like you said, it's if it's being slowly erased in every other formal system, then where else are you supposed to get it? And that's the true revolutionaries. You look back, right? You know your history, right? The true revolutionaries. Yeah. That's how they got the word out, right?
Yep.
And then, you know, something I was going to bring up later, but you just sort of mentioned it, just like springboarding into other things. And I have you to thank. I mean, because knowing about or knowing of is different from knowing about. And one of the things that I got to thank you for is, you know, the Dread Nation, Deathless Divide. We're going to talk. I know you're going to write a third book. I know it. And I have a great idea. And I have a great idea. I have a great idea for it. We'll get to that. But one of the things I really wanted to do, having that chance to thank you about in person, was because I knew about, you know, I knew that there was, of course, you know, strong, important African-American women in the Old West. You know, I'm always great. I always read all the notes and everything. And so I picked up African-American Women of the Old West by Trisha Wagner because of
you. Such a great book. Did you love it?
Because of you.
Yeah.
And like, it's fantastic. Mary Fields, like, come on.
Yeah.
and Annie Box Neal, and like, you just automatically, I'm reading this and I'm like, oh my God, I feel like I'm reading. And this is, you didn't steal it. I'm not suggesting that at all. But I'm just like, you can clearly see like, bits and pieces of Jane and Catherine and in all of them, right? And you can just see where you're like, and you're just reading these great stories and you're like, man, yeah, like of course these stories should be told. And so I just wanted to thank you for that because it is a great book. And anyone out there, Trisha Martineau Wagner wrote it. Again, African-American Women of the Old West. It's fantastic. It's like those stories. I mean, Hollywood pays people hundreds of thousands of dollars to write stories not nearly as good as the stories in this book. So it's important. And I just wanted to thank you for getting me on that path because that was great. I'm glad I read it.
Oh, I'm glad you picked it up. It's
oh yeah, for sure.
It's such a good book.
Yeah, yeah. Fantastic. And okay, so really quickly too. So I wanted to ask you about, because I know you've got children. Do you have one or two or three or eight?
Just one.
Just one. Okay.
just one.
And so she's in school?
She is. She's virtual though. So she.
Okay. I was going to ask how you're dealing with that. And
yeah, we made a decision pretty early on that I teach. I also like, I enjoy teaching. So I teach also college creative writing.
Right.
And kind of as a family, we made a decision very early on that we weren't going to go back to physical spaces until there was like a reliable vaccine that was widely available. Right. So that for us mostly means that like we go grocery shopping and then my husband has like three dudes he goes plays golf with, and that's kind of the extent of our social stuff. Sure. For my daughter, it's not a big deal. Most of her friends live in her phone anyway, so she's perfectly happy.
Great.
But it was mostly the school and like going back and teaching and of course public events. But I think from the most part, most people in like the publishing industry share that sentiment, so it hasn't been a huge deal. But yeah, it's like, so we're virtual. And so she likes it. She doesn't like it. Depends on the day.
Sure.
But yeah, we're fortunate enough to have that privilege that we don't have to worry about sending her to school.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just, it's so scary. You talk to, teachers and people with kids, and it's just, I don't have kids, so I'm very happy I'm not in that position, but I'd have a hard time sending them back. I mean, even just for myself, I remember early on, before they'd made any type of announcements or decisions, I decided I wasn't going to do, you know, Celebration and New York Comic Con and all these other events that we love to go to. I'd made a decision early on I wasn't going to go. And they, of course, made absolutely the right call by not having those things. I couldn't even imagine. I don't know. At this point, I can't imagine being surrounded by 40,000 people ever again. But
right.
Well, it's just like it really, like, my three favorite things, really, like, because I, like, sadly, the pandemic didn't really cramp my style that much. Three things I do like to do is going to the movies, going to concerts, and going to conventions. And, you know, yeah, right. Like, there's just no way, not anytime soon. Even with the vaccine, it's going to be sketchy. But yeah, so many things, because of the pandemic, so many things have moved online. And one of the great things that is coming up next month, and it's connected to you kind of in a way, I guess. One of the things I like about you is that you used to be the executive editor for Fire Magazine.
Yes.
And FireCon is coming up next week, and I'm super stoked about it. I haven't actually seen any of the panels. I'm not so patiently waiting. I volunteered, and I haven't heard back yet if my application has been approved. But I have a ticket anyway, so I'm going to be, you know, part of it no matter what. But I was hoping to be able to just gift my ticket to somebody if I get approved for volunteer.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Are you on any of the panels or anything with that, or no, you're just going to be fanning out?
No, I'm going to be, I think actually I have something else happening next weekend, but I'm like super, like, super excited for them. It looks like a good time. I'm just like trying to like chill. I have a really, really packed schedule. And honestly, like, they are doing their thing. Like, that's like a lifetime ago. Like, I have nothing but, like, I'm just on the sidelines cheering for them. I'm just rooting for everybody black. Yeah, but no, I do think it's great. I do think it's that one of the things that's come out of this, like, terrible time is the return to virtual spaces, which actually allow a lot more people access to things.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, assuming that, you know, we can get everybody internet access, which is, I think, going to be, like, probably one of the next things we have to work on, especially for equity.
It's up in fucking space. Everyone should have it. I don't get it. I don't understand why everyone doesn't have it. That's the one of the great things too. This, if there's, you know, there's silver linings, of course, to most things, and one of them is, yeah, there's an international reach now that there wasn't before. And I, you know, I was watching you with Ms. Grattan the other day, and on the Powell's book panel, you know, just. There's, I don't know, I'm enjoying them. I'm having a great time with these virtual panels. I do feel bad in a sense for the authors. You know, one of the great things and that you guys get to do is go out to the world after you release a book, and you get to, like, you know, throngs of fans get to tell you how great you are and how great the book is and how it's changed their life, and, you know, and you guys deserve all that. And that's the part, you know, it's, you miss, so many authors this year are missing out on that, and especially debut authors, right? That's,
yeah, this is a hard year to release a book,
especially
a debut book. And that's that, like, as a debut, you rely so much on discoverability, which is why, you know, indie bookstores and whatever brick and mortar bookstores that are left are so important. Mm-hmm. So this is a really, really hard year, I think, especially for, you know, that debut book sometimes sets the tone for your career. My debut flopped, no one bought it. For me it was just like a reason to, like, learn how to write better books. Mm-hmm. But I can see it also, like, quite a few of the people who came out my same year, it was kind of their last book, because it just kind of, publishing breaks a lot of writers, like a lot of really good writers that we just never hear about again. And it's because it's so hard to figure out what the right answer is. And the right answer is usually, there's nothing you can do. Like, right. it's levels beyond your ability. And, you know, writers are kind of control freaks. It's why we create whole ass worlds to spend some time in. And so when you realize that, like, the power is completely out of your hands, that's a hard pill to swallow. So yeah, so I do feel for a lot of the debuts, which is why I do think, like, the virtual panels are such a great opportunity for them, because, I mean, these are also debuts who wouldn't necessarily get to do panels somewhere, right?
Right?
If you shouldn't have to pay to send yourself to you know, some sort of festival, some here, there, or anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So it's nice when they have the panels and they can invite, you know, people from all over.
Absolutely.
And they get a little bit more exposure.
Absolutely. And that was one of the things too, like there's such an, you know, obviously it truly does become international in a sense, because people from all over the world can log in and take a look at these panels where they maybe before couldn't have afforded to go to a San Diego or, you know, or they just miss out on tickets, let's say, because there's a limited amount. So it's, if there's a silver lining, and I think that's definitely one of them. I wanted to get into publishing a little bit, but one of the things I wanted to talk about too, because it's fresh. Yeah, it's been a crazy weekend in Star Wars fandom this weekend with all the Mega Carano stuff. And, you know, I have my own opinions on her. I'm mostly able just to leave it at that and move on. But one of the things that has popped up that's interesting, that I find interesting anyways from the conversation, there's a lot of people debating about, you know, separating the art from the artist. And, you know, I see people like, I'm boycotting season 2, and people are like, no, she's not a Nazi. And, you know, so it's like, that's how they justify it. The best example to me is Harvey Weinstein, I think, whenever we talk about this, because he's clearly a monster, but his name is on like 2000 films. And, you know, a lot of those films are good to great films that we've all watched and seen and enjoyed 1,000 times. And I'm just curious where you stand on issues like that. Do you draw a line in the sand? Do you have a line in the sand? I read they did a study one time, and it was like the high 60 percentile of people said they would continue to watch people's art, whether it was music or what movies or whatever, despite what they had done in their personal life. Where do you fall in that category?
You know, this is an ever-changing baseline for me, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I do think, like, for me, I'm never going to give my money to a place where they deny my humanity, right? Like, and that's kind of, or the humanity of others, right? Like, I'm never going to buy another J.K. Rowling book again.
Right.
Would I have bought one of her books before? Probably not. I'm not a huge Harry Potter fan, right? So then it's kind of like, it's an effortless boycott.
So that's an easy one for you, though. Like, right. And same for me. I'm not a Harry Potter fan either. Yeah. So that was an easy one. But like, I'm a huge cinephile. So like, to erase, you know, 200, however many films his name is on. Like at one point I read this thing too, where they're like the top three most thanked people at award shows was God, Steven Spielberg, and Harvey Weinstein. Like,
yeah.
So it's like,
so yeah. And so like for me, like my hardest one was Quentin Tarantino. Like I loved his movies, even Django Unchained, which was obviously like tone deaf and terribly done.
Right.
Like I could see the spirit of what Tarantino was trying to do and enjoy it for that. So that for me was a hard one, but I'm like, obviously he's a piece of shit. So like, I don't need to give him any more of my money.
Right.
And I think it's really about making decisions with your money. I fully endorse anyone who wants to boycott stuff. If someone decides they hate my face and don't want to ever buy any of my books, they're more than welcome to.
Right.
I don't care, honestly, which is one of the funniest things, because people are like, well, if you have no fans, then you're not going to sell any more books. I'm like, yes, that's how it works.
Thank you for explaining.
I'll go do something else, right?
Thank you for explaining that to me. Yeah.
But the reality is that like people have such vastly different experiences and such vastly different perspectives that that's never going to happen, right? And that's the problem. That's where the problem comes in. It's like, you know, if you say, okay, we're not going to give money to people who deny someone's humanity, there's always going to be a handful of people who are like, well, the art says so much more than like their terrible statements. And I'm like, I don't know that it does. Like, there's something about that piece of art that attracted them in the first place.
Right.
So like, what is it? How does that tie back to their own personal belief system? I watched last night, the Wisconsin Dems had a live stream of The Princess Bride. And so like, if you gave like $27, there was a table reading.
Yep.
And it was amazing. But it was very obvious the people who weren't there, because they didn't want to give money to the Wisconsin Dems, and that's okay for them. But then if I don't want to go, you know, and watch their shitty sitcom, that's okay for me. So like,
what's up, Fred? What's up with Fred Savage?
Right. I was like, literally, my husband and I were like, Fred Savage is a Republican? Like, how?
I'm always, I'm like that as well. Similar, where that my thing though, for some reason, is Scientology. Every time I find out someone's a Scientologist, I'm like, huh? But, but, that's a whole other thing. But, yeah, that I saw that. I didn't watch that, but I saw it, you know, everyone was reacting to it. And that was the one thing, that was one of the first things people brought up. They're like, well, I guess we know where Fred Savage is going to vote or something.
It's, I mean, like, I just feel like, wherever you wanted to, you want to draw that line, it's up to you. Mm-hmm. But I'm also okay with people who are like, I hate the social justice warriors and the woke shit being stuck with nothing but Smash Mouth and Kid Rock and like a couple Dean Cain reboots to like watch. Because I'm like, if that's the life choice you're going to make, then like you should be on Shit Show Island with all the rest of them. Like, right. And I think that's probably... I mean, I think it's honestly a lot of smoke. I think at the end of the day, people are going to watch what they want to watch. So even the people who are like, I'm boycotting this thing, will probably go and secretly watch it when it's on TV. And the
I was thinking about that the other day with Mulan, right? Because everyone's they're saying they're boycotting Mulan right now. And, but once it's not $30 and it's just part of the regular stream, they're gonna watch it,
it's
probably.
It's easy to boycott it when you're like, I didn't want to spend that money anyway.
Right. So, and again, it's one thing to like boycott an author, films and TV shows, you know, which take hundreds, if not thousands, of people to make, gets a little trickier because do you punish a whole film, let's say, because one person's an asshole, or you just don't, or maybe they're not an asshole, you just don't agree with them. And so that's, I think, when it gets a little more complicated, and I'm like you in the sense for some things where it's been really easy to not purchase that person's stuff going forward or whatever. I'm not, maybe not going to go and throw out all the stuff I already have, but I'm not going to buy anything or watch anything else in the future. It's like, at the same time, if you want to create change on a set, that's nice, but you have to understand, like, God, I mean, like, nobody, no race, no people's, is a monolith. And, you know, I think your head's in the sand a bit if you think that, you know, there's a huge cast of people and a set of people, and to think that none of them are conservative or don't align with your views is for sure naive at best, or, you know. So, I think you're right. It's such, I just love having that conversation. It's just an interesting one to me. And I'm with you. I struggle with it a bit. Like, I go back and forth, I think, a lot, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, like, it's, for me, it's always going to be, like, in context, right? Yeah. And that's where I think things get tricky, because, like, Twitter and Facebook are where nuance goes to die, right? Like, it's like, there is no nuance within a 40-mile radius of Twitter or Facebook. And so it's either all this or all that, but sometimes it's a combination of things, and you have to, I mean, like, I always have always felt that being an adult is learning to see shades of gray. Mm-hmm. Like, that is really like the worst part of being an adult.
Right. Yes.
I love the liberal, like, gotcha post, but then you're like, that's factually incorrect. Yep. So can we just use facts and not try to make it more than it is?
Right.
I mean, and the same thing happens on like on the conservative side as well. And so I do think when people are like, I'm boycotting this because, you know, they're a social justice warrior, or, you know, they're a Trumper, that is absolutely their right. Mm. Is that going to change their point of view? Probably not.
No.
So like, what's your, like, what are you trying to do? Like, I mean, like, and here's the thing, like, no matter where you fall on, like, which, you know, where you fall belief-wise, in the United States, way more people voted for the Democratic candidate last go-round than the conservative, than the Republican candidate.
Right.
So what dollars do you think companies are going to chase? Yeah, they might give you some breadcrumbs. They might give you some stuff that's going to appeal to whatever your set of beliefs are. But for the most part, they're going to be chasing the majority. And I think that's the conversation, like, people who enjoy, especially in fandom, because I think fandom is where so polarizing, and it's so polarizing over not just, you know, social justice and conservative beliefs, but also just, you know, whether these couple should be together or not. And so I think at some point you just have to figure out, like, like, where do you stand in the fandom? Are you going to be the person who's like, yeah, I'm going to support the stuff that I love and not support the stuff I don't love in hopes that it dies altogether? Or are you going to just get on Twitter and yell about it to people who are not listening? Right. And so I don't know. For me, it's just like, I think it's so much easier to tear stuff down than create that it's sometimes that's where we end up falling. And so for me, I'm trying to, for me, my own personal journey is about stepping back from like the criticism and trying to put my energies more into creating stuff. And letting people do their own shit. Like if you want to be messy, be messy.
Right.
And doesn't, as long as you don't hurt anybody else, it's fine. When you start hurting other people, that's blind strong. So.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, that's hopefully a clear line too. Like, you know, we're talking about like subtleties sort of nuance, not like, you know, somebody murdered somebody and they're from your favorite TV show or,
right, or like,
yeah. I think we're all clear on that line. Right. Or they've come out as a Nazi or whatever. Like we're
Nazis. Like that's a hard
right. But you know,
He's a Nazi. Okay. No, I'm not watching that show anymore. Like,
but these are not uncomplicated times. And it's, you know, we're like you said, the Twitter mob on either side, you know, is going after things, you know, like as simple as who you voted for, which, you know, is something I don't understand that why people take for granted being able to vote. Please don't. Yeah. Cause Black folks and other people of color didn't get to do that for a very long time. So please, everyone vote.
Whatever side you're going to
vote for, just understand that it's a privilege.
Right. Like I think coming out saying I'm not going to vote is kind of like, you suck. But
yeah,
fine,
I don't like
right?
that point of view at all.
I'm not going to like boycott you. But if you're like, you come out and you're like, you know, I'm a Nazi, then I'm like, okay, you get to put in the timeout box because I need you to like suffer those consequences. Yeah. I think that's what it is. It's like, people, you know, like I have people in my mentions all the time trying to come for me and I just mute them because I'm like, you can keep yelling at me. I'm just never going to see it again. And it's also brings me joy to know that they just rail into the abyss. Like, just like put your feelings out there. I hope you feel better, buddy. And I think that's really like where we need to get back to is we need to get back to like, you know, like when I was a kid, my mom was like, just don't engage with them. And sometimes if you're trapped in a small space, it's hard not to engage with someone. But it's like the internet is a vast and multitudinous space. It's like, if you don't want to engage with those people, just mute that. You can mute, once you're a verified user on Twitter, especially, you can mute whole ass words. You never have to see whole ass words. I never have to see Trump again, right? I also muted Arby's because I don't like the Arby's ads. It always so I never have to see an Arby's ad again, right?
I muted a Star Wars word recently, which would get my Star Wars card revoked. I'm not going to say it.
It's fine, and
not because I disagreed with what was being said about it, just because it was just inundated with it. It was just too much, right?
I think it's okay not to care about some things. Right?
Yeah, it was too much. I'll unmute it later, right? But for right now, it was just going through a period where it was like popping up and everything. I'm like, I can't read another article about this.
Yeah.
Time is ticking away. I did want to mention, I wanted to talk about a couple of important things before we talk about, you know, you're an author. Remember, we forget that. I didn't bring you on to talk about politics. but this is connected for sure, I think, the two, because we talk about how crazy a year it's been and what sort of like, you know, I've been calling the Black Lives Matter bump for a lot of Black authors received earlier this year.
Yeah.
And one of the things you tweeted, which surprised me a little bit, maybe not, I don't know, but you mentioned something about your sales in June eclipsed even your released month, for Deathless Divide, and like that's crazy. And I've been asking other authors, you know, Black authors, about the Black Lives Matter bump and what their experience was with it, and you know, what was yours. Because a lot of the times, and it's disheartening to hear, not surprising, but disheartening at the same time, because you always want this time to be the change, right? The time that actually changes it. And then there was a lot of activity early on, but it's petered out now, right? So, but that was surprising a bit, because June sort of was after the fact, right? It was after the initial, you know, hype. What was that like for you? Like, describe sort of like how it's been for you as a Black author receiving more attention than maybe you would have normally.
I think it's kind of, it's a bitter pill, to be honest, because like, you don't, like, no author like sits up and says, I'm going to be the black author who writes zombies, right?
Like, yep.
It's
yep.
like, it's like, we used to have a joke. So my in-laws are, they're Trump fans, so we don't talk to them. Yep. But in the early days of my marriage, I remember going to visit my in-laws. And, you know, my husband and I met in the Army. So we both kind of came from this very like, and not all of the Army is very diverse, but our stuff was pretty diverse, our unit was. And so like, I remember going to my in-law's house and my mother-in-law telling a story about Black Doris. And I was like, I'm like looking at my husband and he's like looking at me and I'm like, why is she called Black Doris? And my mother-in-law is like, oh, because there's another Doris that works there as well. Oh, and God. My husband's like, so why don't you call her Doris and call the other Doris White Doris, right? And of course, my mother-in-law didn't get it, like went over her head. But I've always remembered that moment because it's like, I don't want to be Black Doris. I just want to be Doris. And yeah. I think every Black author just wants to be an author. We become Black authors because there's so few of us. And because like that's, you know, in publishing, you end up taking every single moment opportunity you can to stand out from the rest of the crowd. And sometimes that's just something as simple as race. And so like when you're, you know, there are white authors who write about race, but they're not considered, you know, white authors writing about race. They're just writing about life. Mm-hmm. And so like, I think that's like, it's part of like what makes it so bitter. It's like, I'm so happy people found my book. Do I wish they had found it because it's just a great book? Yeah. But however I can get them in the door, then maybe they'll go read other authors who also happen to be Black. Right. And, you know, that'll be a thing. We have the adult side, I will say, you know, it's completely different, especially in, you know, science fiction and fantasy. Like, it's still very, very homogenous. It's still very few, you know, Black authors. But in YA, we've been having kind of a moment for a couple of years now, right, where we're having more and more fantasy being published by Black authors or speculative fiction, not always fantasy. Sometimes there's some little bit of sci-fi, you know, in things like funny romantic comedies and all these things. And so like, I feel at this point, you know, you should just be reading authors. The problem is like, there's still that kind of, you know, compartmentalization that happens where you have the authors and then you have the Black authors and then you have the authors and then you have the Latinx authors and then you have the authors and then you have the queer authors, right? And it's like, we should just have like stories and we should be to the point where it's just like, you pick up my book because it's a good book, because, you know, so your friend told you it's an amazing book, not because you're like, well, there's a Black girl on the cover and I haven't read any Black people all year, so I'm going to read this book, right? Yeah. And that's kind of where it's like, it's like, I appreciate the sales. Obviously, I have bills. Every other Black author has bills. Every other author, period, has bills. At the same time, you just want people to like your books because you're writing good stories, not because you fill a quota.
Right. It shouldn't be a political statement every time Justine Ireland releases a book.
Right.
Right. And my thing, too, is just as one of the things I wanted to bring up. Did you see Case and Callender's article?
Which one? The one they wrote?
About black queer publishing, Black and queer
representation
of publishing, because he mentions you.
Oh, cool.
And I'll read the quote to you, and it's a compliment. Don't worry. You're like, I know. Sorry, that I didn't word that. That was poor wording on my part. I'll read. So he's talking about just, you know, he just. The numbers, basically, like how little still, you know, Black queer in middle grade and YA, and the numbers, yeah. The numbers are still way askew. So he says, this is quoting him. He says, to my knowledge, there's only one Black queer book by a Black queer author that has hit the New York Times bestseller list on the children's side, Dread Nation by Justine Ireland. It's also interesting to me that this is an SFF title, almost as if we need to be killing zombies to be considered exciting and that our contemporary voices still aren't enough yet. End quote. So what's your reaction to that? And also, it's fucking crazy to me. And it's, of course, it's worthy of the list because Dread Nation's fantastic, but that's the last one. He's according to him.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's unsurprising.
Yeah.
Melinda Lowe did a study. Like, I bet that's one of the things I love about YA is we have so many smart authors doing really smart, really smart work, you know, both on the, like the book page and also off the book page.
Right.
But Melinda Loeb did a study, it's probably 3 or 4 years ago, looking at reviews of books when the character, main character occupied more than one axis of oppression, right? So Black queer characters, Latin queer characters who were also disabled, Black characters who were also disabled, those sorts of things. And what she found was that basically people feel like it's too much, right? It's fine if I'm reading a story about being Black, but when I read a story about being Black and disabled, it's too much. Like those, like disabled Black people don't exist. And I think that's where we're still at. Like, I don't think Kaysen is wrong, is that we're still in the idea of that's too much oppression for a reader to get behind. Mm-hmm. And I mean, and like I totally agree, which is one of the reasons why, you know, we don't really find out Jane's sexuality really until like, you know, 3/4 of the way through Dread Nation. And it's, you know, it's more obvious on the page for Deathless Divide because it's a sequel. And I'm like, well, if you're already with me through the end of Dread Nation, you're, you know, you're going to be fine with this, seeing this on the page in Deathless Divide.
Right.
But one of the things I wanted to do, because I'm already bringing readers into a world that's like very racist and very hierarchical and very much, you know, an unrepentant reflection of the ills in our society that we don't like to talk about. I wanted to make sure that like, if I would introduce Jane as bisexual and Black on the first page, then people wouldn't have probably stuck around.
Right.
I mean, there some people would have, but there's probably a good portion of people, and they wouldn't know why they were putting the book down. They would just be like, oh, I can't connect with the character, or oh, you know, it's just a little too much. I definitely agree with Kaysen, and I do think Black authors writing about queerness also tend to get more backlash than white authors writing about queerness. And I say that because of Nick Stone's Odd One Out, which is literally about, you know, kind of like that idea of, you know, of bisexuality and those sorts of things, and kind of dealing with those like weird, you know, interrelationships. And like, there's a lot of backlash on it because people hated the way the one character was portrayed. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you know, sometimes when you have a queer book, not all of your queer characters are going to make good decisions, especially if they're teenagers.
Right.
So, you know, like for every, you know, cute rom-com that features, you know, queer people, we need those stories where like, maybe it's about, you know, queer people of color in like a dysfunctional relationship. Like maybe we have to show those stories as well.
Right.
And I do think that's, you know, kind of what Kaysen is speaking to. In that
sure. Way. And he, you know, and he mentions also, You Should See Me in a Crown, which didn't make the bestsellers list. And he was sort of saying like, if that can't this year, then like,
yeah,
you know, he was pointing to that as sort of like, you know, a failure on the industry part, using that as his, you know, his indication that the industry isn't there yet. It's not where it needs to be. It's not even close.
And it's not even the industry. It's the readers, right? So
sure.
This is a conversation I always get lost in because, you know, people are like, well, readers need to find these books. I'm like, the problem here is the industry creates the market.
Right.
And so at some point we've all agreed that the market for Black books is really about racism and somehow tangentially related to that. Right. And so like, you know, there have been a couple books that have hit the list that aren't explicitly about oppression. But most are, even if in a sideways, you know, Danielle Clayton's The Bells hit the list, but that's still, you know, at a slant angle about oppression and about, you know, slavery and those sorts of things and lack of personal, like being able to make your own choices. Right.
Yeah.
And so like, that's kind of like where the challenge lies, is if you're an author, a Black author who wants to write about just like fun, fluffy, sweet rom-coms, you're probably not going to get the same push as the person who writes the next The Hate U Give. Mm-hmm. And not that we don't need books like The Hate U Give. It's a phenomenal book. It's just that we need to see those books that you know, espouse Black joy as well. Mm-hmm. In fact, like sometimes I get emails and people are like, oh, I'm doing a display for Black History Month at my library. And I, you know, I wanted to include your book. Can I get like the high res art? And I always write back, I'm like, my book is good. Why don't you like showcase this book instead?
Right.
You know, and I think that's like, I think that's one of the problems is like, you know, if you have a book display and it's Me and The Hate U Give and Children of Blood and Bone and like something by Jason Reynolds, like Long Way Down. And like, you know, just like, it's just all these books about like how terrible it is to be Black, right? Which isn't the point of the books at all, but what people take away from them.
Yeah.
Then it tends, you tend to not look for those other types of books. You tend to figure like that's what Black literature looks like. And that's not true. Black literature is just as diverse and just as, you know, full of different kinds of identities as every other book. Every other storytelling, which is why I like anthologies, honestly, because like you get to see that like that depth and breadth of storytelling.
Right, and there's also this thing too that I've seen, and it troubles me is you know, people look at contemporary Black fiction as not representative of like today, right? Like it's it reads to them as not real or fantasy almost, and. So it's like, you can't even win with that. Like here you are, you know, like here you are depicting what it's like currently right now in the country you live in, and people write it off as fantasy in a way. And, you know, that type of stuff troubles me greatly. Getting these books out there. And like you said, you write, there's the list of people, a lot of, you know, people could name three or four, but like you said, there's so many getting lost in the shuffle and there's so many we've never heard of and we might never get a chance to hear of. And that's the part that I think is really important right now. And
which is why I want to take a moment to shout out to Melanin and YA. It's a new database that was just started by Melody Simpson. And it's a great resource for Black YA, for Black YA authors, for their books, for just a way of getting eyes on, you know, the depth and breadth of stories that are being told. Because I do think people tend to just like look at the list or look at what's on the front shelf in their local indie or Barnes and Noble. You're in Canada, right? So you guys have Indigo.
Yeah.
And so like I do think like,
well, don't say it like that, Justin. You're Canada. In Canada, right?
I forgot you're in Canada until you said sorry, and then I was like, oh, that's right.
You with your low pandemic numbers.
I know. Yeah. Your universal health care. An indigo.
These indigos.
Indigos. Gosh. Yeah, but no, so I do think it's a great resource because I don't expect everybody to know everything.
Yeah.
But like you should know the resources that are there to help you know more.
My thing too is I always tell folks, and too, I'm like, if you're not like it's all personal taste, I guess, at the end of the day, but like if you're not reading these books, you like it's like you're closing yourself off to all these great stories. It's like, why wouldn't you want to be aware of what else is out in the world? It'd be like only shopping for pants in a third of the store. Like, don't you want to know what pants are on the other side of the store? Like there's amazing, like I'm at the point now where I'm reading 2021 releases now. Right. So
yeah.
I've got a good idea of like my favorites of the year have been, and I'm just like, I'm not kissing up to anybody. It's just like a lot of them, most of them are Black authors. Like I just can't help it. They just fucking write great stories. So why wouldn't, like, don't shut yourself off from that. And one of those books is Deathless Divide. and you know, the great end start, the prologue is fantastic. You know, we didn't really get a chance to talk about it when it came out because I was still with another site at the time. And but I mean, it's just beautifully layered, grounded in all the best ways, covers just about everything, class and race and everything you'd expect from a zombie apocalypse set during the Civil War. So everything that encompasses that. It's such an important book. It's a highly entertaining book. The plot, the plotting, the pacing is so strong and sturdy. And it's just like scene after scene after scene is great. I love the layout. I love that the chapters go back and forth between Jane and Catherine. I love that, you know, Catherine's quotes are all biblical up until, you know, a certain point. And that is completely reflective of her state of mind. And it's beautiful the way you did it. It's not even revisionist because, like I said earlier, you know, there were women that did these things back then that people need to know about. Jane and Kat, this is where I just kiss your ass for a second. because we never there's no question here because I never got to do this before, right? So this is like
it's fine. I just all of a sudden I flash to that point where you're in a con and someone's like stands up, they're like, this is more of a statement than a question.
Yeah. And like, because I do love these books, and one of the things too that I've been reading a lot about is colorism and passing versus assimilation, and it's so great the way you handled that, just the subtlety too, you know, you just the way you wrote Catherine. I love Catherine so much. I love that character. It ends with the, and we head out off to find the truths of the world. Like, that's such a great way to end a book, but it's also, it just opens up so many possibilities too. And I mean, is there more left to tell, or are you done with that, with Catherine and Jane and Daniel even now too?
It's so hard to write in that world. Although the more this world sucks, the easier that world gets.
Right.
But like this sequel, this is gonna forever be the book that damn near broke me, because it's so hard to take your kids on another trip after they barely survived the first one. Like if you go on a boat trip and your kid falls overboard and nearly drowns, are you ever going to get on a boat again?
Right.
And like for me, the answer is no. Obviously that bad thing happened once. I don't want to do it again. And so like putting my characters back in this like terrible world and like living through that, those experiences with them again, was really hard. It was actually harder than I thought it would be. Because people really liked the first book, and it's probably the first book that I've written where more than 10 people liked it, because all my books before that, it was like, 10 people liked it, and I appreciate those 10 people. So like I was getting a lot of feedback when I was trying to write the sequel to Dread Nation, and the feedback was overwhelmingly positive, which I did not know until it happened, also makes it difficult to write a book. We always hear about like the negative feedback, how negative feedback and those your inner critic makes it hard to write, but the external praise also makes books hard to write as well. And so when I finished the second book, I was like, I'm done. I don't want to do anymore. Like that second book is so freaking long, because I wanted to put all the things I wanted to talk about in there, which is kind of why it's basically two books. Like people are like, there's a weird time jump in the middle. I'm like, yes, it's two books. I gave you two books, right? It's a deal. Two books for the price of one.
A zombie apocalypse story set in the Civil War, and they're like worried about a little time jump. Like, come on. Like, this is so unbelievable.
Much, there's so much other stuff that you should be picking on. I do sometimes think about writing more stories. I think about the other characters, you know, what happens to Sue and her husband and Lily. And I think about like, you know, where, you know, Ida goes off on her own to like basically with Lucas to try to figure out. Like these characters are like, I've lived with them for so long. They're basically real people. So sometimes it's like, I'd like to check in with them. But I don't know that I would want to write another full length book. I would like to tell like a prequel, like, you know, let's talk about what the world was like before Jane McKean. Like, you know, what did those initial years after the zombie apocalypse look like, right? That's most of our zombie fiction is like that upheaval moment. And it's like, so, you know, you have the Civil War going on. Like, let's talk about some of the things that were happening to Black people during the Civil War. Like, one of the things a lot of people don't know is that as the South marched north, they kidnapped freedmen and sent them south and enslaved them, right? Like, you're property of the South. We're sending you south. And you're like, wait, I'm free. I've been free for, you know, my family's been free for 50 years.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there was a lot of that happened. Southern Pennsylvania in particular had a number of settlements that were freedmen settlements. I went to school in one of them, Shippensburg, Pennsylvania. And like the historical record for Black people just kind of disappears in like the 1860s when you know, they were marching north, because those people no longer lived in town. And so like you have to wonder like, oh my God, that's such a rich space for storytelling. But at the same time, like I have new stories I want to tell, and there's other things I want to delve into, and history is such a fertile ground for storytelling. That I'm like, okay, maybe I want to talk about the Dust Bowl and what that looks like for Black people. You know, that very traditionally very white storytelling of the Dust Bowl. Like, what's that look for like for Black folks? And just like I think that's kind of where I am. Like, does it mean there will never be another like Dread Nation set book? I have bills, so at some point I might need to go back to the well. But for now, I think I'm happy to let those characters kind of.
But just we need a trilogy.
I know so many every week someone's like, "There's a fifth book, right?" I'm like, "No, there's two books." They're at a good spot. They end in a good spot.
But clearly, like, that's just a massive compliment, right? Because
of course.
You know, you understand that. Yeah, what we're saying is you've created such a great story with characters we've fallen in love with, and you just want more. I mean, it's like, that's the hard part, especially now, like, you know, like what's coming out tomorrow, Legendborn comes out tomorrow, and you know, god damn it, to the person that, like, it's like, I want to wait for Legendborn to have read Legendborn, because just to have to stop and wait is so, it's like when the Lord of the Rings movies came out, right?
Yeah.
And you got to wait 2 years or whatever it was. It's like,
forever.
It's so hard when you love something so much and then you got to wait for more. It's so hard. And I think you see the compliment right there in that with Deathless Divide, with these characters.
Oh yeah, most definitely.
Because it's weird. They're like in a weirdly good place right now. Yeah. It's like you're like, oh yes, they're at, you know, minus an arm, although she's got a cool metal arm now, Jane, is that they're at full strength, kind of, in a way that they haven't been in a very long time, and they're connected in a way, in a very intimate and profound way. And I love that intimacy between Jane and Catherine, and you know, intimacy takes on many forms, right? It's not not what most people, young boy, gross boys, think it means. So let me put it this way. If they came back to you and said, we wanted a third book, like, from you as soon as possible, would you, you've got some ideas though, or no, or you'd have to really sort of rent a cabin in the woods and hammer out some stuff?
I have ideas. I always,
I'm not asking what they are. I'm just saying, you can email me to them later. Cause I have an idea. It involves time travel. So it's Dread Nation, Deathless Divide meets Quantum Leap, if that sort of any
time travel through their lifetime.
Yes, the three of them are going to go around.
Just waiting for the trip home.
It's kung fu, kind of. They're going to go around solving, they're going to go around solving people's problems until they can find their way back home.
That's awesome.
Okay, we're like out of time, and I'm going to let you go here, but I can't ask about Vern, because I love Vern. You know, when they were all the high, I know you can't talk about it, but I think we'll be able to talk about it in this sense only. You know, they were rolling out all the big rollouts for High Republic earlier on with the press event and all these things and all the art reveals and book reveals. And you know, I'm on board 100,000% with this, the High Republic project. It looks great. I cannot wait to get my hands on these things. But I'm also, I got to be a little honest, like when they were, you know, Reith Silas, Stellan Geos, Keith Trennis, Evar Chris, all these characters, I'm just like, meh, kind of bland. And, you know, obviously there's things I need to learn about them, but just, you know, surface level basic stuff, I'm like, meh, okay, sure, yeah, great. But then I remember I saw Vern Estra and I was like, holy fuck, look at this. Look at the look on her face. Look at her. Like, she's, when I first saw Vern, she knocked me off my feet a little bit. I was in love instantly with this character. It's just something about the look on her face, and then you read about her, and you're just, and you know more about her, and you're just like, that's what I'm like. Yours is the one I'm looking forward to most. Just really quickly, are you able to talk about just sort of like where Vern came from without revealing anything that you're not supposed to?
Yeah, I mean, like, I think most of the characters you're going to see in these, like, initial runs of books are characters that were created by the author who's using them.
Right.
So, you know, like, you know, Keeve is Cav's, like, you know, creation. Like, he was like, okay, you know, Black Lady Jedi, this is who I'm going to follow. You know, and this is her, you know. So we always call it in storytelling the hole in their heart. Like, the thing that they, like, are missing, that they need to, like, that they're searching for, right? Whether they know it or not. So, like, we always use, you know, I think it's Michael and the Godfather looking for his father's approval, right? That's the thing that drives all of his actions throughout the movie series, the hours and hours of the movies. And so, like, you know.
You're like, just get over it already.
Yeah. And so for when I was thinking of Vernestra, first of all, I always hated, like, the short shrift of the Miri Allens in the prequels. I always felt like they're so cool and they look neat and like they kind of just like are like, they don't get the best storylines. Mm-hmm. But mostly I wanted to write about a young Jedi, right? Like, cause we tend to think that the only like amazing young Jedi in the entire like 10,000 year history of the Jedi was Anakin Skywalker. And I'm like, there's gotta be others, right? just because history has forgotten them doesn't mean that there weren't other, other awesome young Jedi with like an immense, amount of possibility. But what happens like when you're the younger like kid in the group and everyone kind of is just like, go babysit, right? Like what's that push pull feel like? And so that's how like it came up with Renestra. Like I also have always really loved the non-human, although almost every alien race or species in Star Wars is some sort of humanoid, but I've always loved like the non-human Jedi, because I feel like that has to be a different kind of experience for them, right? And I think, sure, we default to humans because it's like it's easier, but like sometimes it's easier for us to recognize our own humanity in non-human creatures. And so like, that's one of the reasons I want to go to Vern. Also, green skin is just cool. And they have, the Miri Allens have awesome face tattoos, which is also cool. So like, there's just also a degree of coolness. I mean, and also to be honest, like my heart's always been with the scoundrels in the Star Wars galaxy. So, although Vern is a Jedi, there are also some really awesome other characters that you haven't seen yet that I'm really excited about as well.
Are you 100% her, like having her be Merlian and purple lightsaber? Is that 100% you?
Oh yeah, like
yeah, okay. Okay.
One day we will discuss the passive aggressive battle for the purple lightsaber. But I also, I love the purple lightsaber because I love Mace Windu.
Sure.
Literally, like I still sometimes sit here in quiet moments and I'm like, man, they did him wrong. Like,
oh, they did. Yeah, for sure.
In my headcanon, he didn't die when he fell out the window. He had this awesome, the gunfighter reformed story arc that continued into Order 66 and all sure. that kind of stuff. So one day maybe Lucasfilm will let me write those stories.
That's been put out there. I've seen sort of other people theorize, that he's you get on the 2 a.m. Twitter crowd and you see that he's Mace Windu still alive. Yeah, that would be something.
I fully believe Mace Windu lives. I mean, there not now, but in the past he did.
Sure, right. Well, yeah, I want to let you go, but I couldn't let you go without saying, asking about Vern, and I cannot wait to read more about her and learn more about her. And, a test of courage is not just because I'm talking to you right now. It really is. I've posted stuff about Vern before on Twitter, so I'm Vern's. That's what I'm all about, Vern. So
yay.
I cannot wait. I really can't wait. And that means, and we'll get to talk again in the new year, hopefully.
When
the date? Has it changed again? Is it still?
No, it's January.
January, yeah.
It's January.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
is like not that far away.
It's not. I know.
But also, there are arcs. I have some. So.
I'll be talking to Lyssa. She's great. She'll hook me up for sure. I have no doubt. So,
yeah.
Oh yeah, no, that's again very, very, very fortunate. I won't have to wait till January.
Yeah, but no, I think January. I think it's going to be a nice thing to look forward to. January, especially depending on how this American election goes.
Or we'll be moving to Sweden or something.
I got my eye on New Zealand, so
is that what it is? That's where you're going? Okay,
that's where I want to go. I feel like it'd be nice to be on the other side of the globe for a little while, see what it's like down there.
It's really hard right now. We love visiting the U.S. so much, but I don't think I'm going to be able to get my wife to go. I used to be able to get her into blue states, but now I don't think.
Yeah.
If this election goes shifts right again, I don't know what we're going to do.
It'll be interesting. I think because like in 2016, everybody. I know I'm a long talker, so you can just edit whatever you. At the end.
But I'll talk to you for 4 hours if you want. I feel bad about keeping you.
It's fine. I like talking, so it's like I always feel bad. I usually caveat when I get on a podcast with somebody like, okay, I'm a long talker, so
you
have
stuff
to edit if you need to. But yeah, I think people thought things wouldn't change after 2016, and I think things have changed more than they thought. And so it is, considering what the next 4 years would look like under another Trump presidency, is I think concerning.
The scary part is what else can he do in another term where it gets to the point where the things can't be undone?
Yeah. Because and I think that's the thing. It's like, I think people think that the Constitution is like, isn't as malleable as it is. And I think that's one of our concerns, as Americans, is like that the Constitution is really what's kept us in business for the last couple hundred years. And without, like, if we go into a constitutional crisis and no one does anything, we're kind of just, you know, at that point, it's like we're just kind of governing by like shoulder shrugs, right? Like, then yeah. at that point, capitalism has undermined democracy, and we're all kind of screwed.
Well, that's it.
Yeah, and that's kind of like, I think that's where, like, what's terrifying for us. You know, we don't have necessarily the same social net that a lot of other, you know, nations that are at our same, like, economic status do. And
right.
it kind of, even those personal liberties and stuff start to erode as well. I think for hopefully people either care or they won't. They'll just make TikTok videos and, you know.
Some people are able to do that, eh? They're just able to tune it out. I don't know. I'm not built that way. I get the sense you're not either.
No, I'm not. And yeah, it's hard. It's hard.
It is hard.
Especially like, you know, like raising a child in like, you know, a country where you're like, are we going to have to be like, you know, like Russia, or are we just kind of pretend like we all go along to get along no matter what our true feelings are? Or, you know, are we going to get to be the America that we can be, the country that I fought for because I believed in it? So
Right. And then, you know, and then as a military family and a Black family, like, it's a weird time for you. I mean, it's how do you, like, in raising a daughter, and you, like, how do you, I don't know. How do you,
I mean, it's even more like complex because my husband's white. So okay. like we have like, I mean, it's just, it's weird. It's a weird time. It's weird. I will say I'm lucky enough. I live in a suburb, and you know, sure. we have a fair number of Trump signs, stuff like that. But I have seen also a number of, you know, love is love, you know, people are not, no human is illegal. And like, that kind of like, you know, the pushback against the Trump stuff kind of, you know, blooming in my area. So I do think as hard as this year has been, and you know, it's been a lot harder for some people than others. I do think there are people who are starting to pay attention who maybe didn't before. And that's what gives me hope. That's what makes me think, okay, yeah. things can get better, because people who were just like, it'll be fine, are now like, okay, it hasn't been fine. Let me actually do something about it now.
That's the hope, is that you know, the people that were arguing in 16, like, well, let's give them a chance, or I'll give them the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
Like, now there's we have the receipts, and
yeah,
so many receipts. But if you're, you know, and at this point, after all that, if you're still, you know, leaning right of center, then I just don't know what to tell you. And it's just, everything that's going on is just so hurtful. And that's the part that scares me the most, is that to see that continue would just be awful, because, you know, you see the stuff on TV and the things people are saying and doing to each other, and really, really more specifically what's happening to marginalized groups. And
it really
hurts me, right? It breaks my heart. And that's the stuff that I key in on, because if I think about all the stuff that he's doing right now, and like, we're talking like parks and wetlands and wildlife and environmental policies. And like, these are the things that I'm really talking about not being undone. Like, what, you know, you can only stretch those things too far. Then they,
our entire West Coast is on fire. Like I know everyone's like, California catches on fire every year. I'm like, but Oregon doesn't.
No.
And Colorado doesn't.
I know.
And Colorado's a little further interior, but like literally the entire Western United States is like one giant fire. I'm like, if that doesn't make you wake up and going like, what the hell is happening? We need to make some changes to our life. I don't know. I don't know what to do. Tell you.
Yeah. Like that's the frustrating part, right? Is that, you know, you see it and you're just like, how can you not react to that in some way? And then, you know, like, again, the hope is people have enough people, you know, what do we need? 400 people in Michigan to change their minds, and, you know, 1,000 in Wisconsin, 1,000 in Wisconsin,
and counting on you,
like with
Pennsylvania.
With this, you know, it's clear we're going to be stuck with this fucking racist electoral college for probably forever, sadly.
Yeah.
It's, you know, so we got to just, you know, the margins are so small, and that's why.
That's my dream. That's my political dream. Not my personal political dream, but my dream for this country is that we have a blue wave this year. And the first thing, you know, a Democratic controlled House and Senate does with a, you know, Democratic president is eliminate the electoral college, because that's really the only way you can get rid of it. And once you eliminate the electoral college, then it's just, Like, we're then we're like everybody else. I mean, electoral college is racist anyway. It was based on slaveholding.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. No. Exactly.
That's my soapbox. The electoral college. I have a whole ass lecture about it.
Yeah. So, yeah. No. Yeah. Well, that's the thing, and that's God, that's not even a fucking secret anymore. Like that information is out there for people to read, and that's the hard part is when people do read it, finally take the time to read and educate themselves, and they're still just like shoulder shrug, and you're like, come on, you're not mad about that? Like,
I think if you're not mad, it's because you're not paying attention, and hopefully maybe like with more like I like you know
or you're a Nazi people. Or you're
yeah or you're a Nazi, in which case I guess you're living your best life,
right? Right. Well, that's the thing. Like I'm a vegan, so a lot of times that you know I there's people that you know like when I was young I read certain books and watched certain videos that and said to me is like, oh, we can't treat animals like that, I'm gonna stop eating them.
Yeah.
But then there's people that watch and read the same things I did and again just shoulder shrug and then dig into their hamburger or steak or whatever. So people are just our empathy neurons are just developed differently. I truly believe that, because like you said, how could you look at, we could both look at the same video of some type of brutality happening to somebody and react differently. And we're both, and we're both human beings, but we're reacting differently to something that's clearly abusive.
Yeah. So I mean, like literally I'm the person who looks at the video and I'm like, farming sucks. And then I go eat a steak. So like,
and that's fine. And that doesn't mean worse than the other person. Right.
But I mean, I think that's worth discussing is like, so like, you know, what are the things that happen in my life where I'm like, that's just how things are. What are the things that happen in other people's life where they're like, okay, well, you know, all lives matter, not just Black lives. And they skirt around that conversation. Like, how do we reach people in those places where they're least comfortable to make those changes? And that's, I think that's where great fiction honestly comes in, is I think sometimes, you know, when we don't expect there to be that tough conversation there, that's when we're most ready to have that tough conversation.
Sure. And at the very least, you can sort of dress it up in you know, murdering zombies. But and so you can, it's like, and again, I'll bring it back to me for a second. Like when I first turned vegan, it's been 26 years now.
Good on you. That's so hard.
It was hard at the beginning. It's easy now, obviously, you get used to it. But at the beginning, like my mom would try and sneak meat into my food, right? Because she didn't understand it. And right. So it's like now, like if you got to sneak some education into, you know, something dressed up in a sci-fi sensibility or a fantastical sensibility, then so be it. Right. Because if people aren't, like you said earlier, if people aren't going to seek out like the actual historical books or, you know, then we're going to have to get it into them somehow one way or another. So, and that's why authors are, again, you guys are kind of like the revolutionaries in a lot of ways, you know, because if the system allows it, of course, which is another discussion altogether, getting these stories out, and it's more important than ever that, you know, we support Black authors, I think, for that reason, because these stories haven't historically been allowed to get out. And the longer we let that happen, the more they get erased. And there's already too much huge gaps in history for Black culture.
I think also it just humanizes Black people, to be honest.
Yes.
I think that's the biggest thing, is like if you live in a neighborhood where there are no Black people and you go to school, there are no Black kids, and you don't know anyone who's Black, and your first exposure to a Black person is, you know, your only exposure to a Black person is seeing them as criminals on the evening broadcast, then of course, you know, it's really hard to like understand why it's not okay for a police officer to shoot someone 7 times in the back. And so I do think like that's humanizing, you know, Black.
Well, but there was a knife in that city somewhere though.
Yeah, somewhere in the vicinity of that neighborhood, there was a weapon.
There was a knife in one of those houses. I know it. Yeah. I know it. You can't convince me otherwise.
These magical knives that just keep appearing everywhere.
It's amazing. It's amazing. It's amazing how they're able to do that. Yeah.
I was like, I got a knife in my car too, because I got plastic cutlery in there. Like, is that going to be just like?
And that's so. And that's again to the differences in people. They're like, they see that video and they're like, I see a knife. I'm like, I see a fucking hand. I don't see a knife. But you know, like, there's just some people who, you know, who can't be convinced, I'm sure of it. But we don't need everyone. We just need some of them, right? So,
right.
Yes. So a test of courage comes out in January.
Yes.
You can be, of course, you're at justineireland.com, and of course, you're on Twitter and all those great things. I can't wait touch base again in a couple, 2, 3, 4, 5 months, whenever we get a chance to talk again about Star Wars and Vern and all that other fun stuff. And then by then we'll have more stuff to talk about politically, unless, again, we're both moving to different parts of the
world. Unless I've liquidated all my assets and I'm on the run.
It's like, and I'm even in Canada, so I'm still just like, I don't even want to be near it. And, you know, we're looking at maybe a fall election too, and our conservatives are, you know, are not the same, obviously, as the ones in the U.S., but we've got some issues that I'm trying to keep a close eye on stuff up here too. So we don't want it to spread.
Yeah.
In the bud. Like zombies, like diseased zombies. We don't want it to spread. So anyway, Justin, thanks so much for doing this.
Great talking to you.
Yeah, I appreciate it greatly. Enjoy the rest of your week and the rest of your year, and good luck with the homeschooling and all the other stuff. And I hope the rest of the year finds you safe and healthy and well. And we will talk, if not in the new year, then maybe sooner.
There you have it, another episode of Everything is Canon all wrapped up. A huge thanks to Justina for taking the time to speak with me. As always, the pleasure was all mine. She's wonderful to talk to, and it's a wellspring of knowledge on pretty much any subject. So, if you get the chance to talk to her, I highly suggest you take advantage of it. You can find her on justinaireland.com, on Twitter at @justinaireland. Make sure you go to bookshop.org and pick up Deathless Divide and Dread Nation if you haven't already. While you're on Twitter, make sure you check out Melanin YA, a resource for all things Black and traditional YA, a great resource put together by Melody Simpson. As always, be sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you choose to listen. Head on over to cinetlinks.com for all the latest movie, TV, books, and gaming news. Bye for now. Our time has come, it's time to go.